Hi, Derev Tov to everyone. Welcome to part three of The Presidents and the Jews, sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Ili Nishmas Yonah ben Rab Aryeh Leib, Tenishmoso, Surah B'Tzorah Chaim. Tonight we'll discuss James Madison. So three of the first four presidents were 57 years old when they took office. It's a good age. The third being Madison, 1809 to 1817. Madison was not a natural politician at all. Instead, he was something much rarer today. He was a thinker, a logician, a negotiator, a philosopher, a political scientist, a legal scholar. He thought about ideas. Now, he began his political career at an early age as Thomas Jefferson's protege, rising to become his Secretary of State. But Madison was one of those founders about whom it is hard to see how he would be elected today. He was short, the shortest president we've had at 5'4". In presidential elections of the last century, almost always tall defeat short. Just go through it, you know, think of Dukakis and Carter against Reagan, etc. It's rare that the shorter person wins. But Madison was also sullen, colorless, misunderstood. He usually dressed in black. For most of his life, especially in his teens and 20s, he was quite sickly, but he became a very powerful political personality. It was John Quincy Adams who dubbed Madison the father of the Constitution, and that ultimately was even more important than his presidency. But even Madison didn't get everything he wanted in the Constitution, and understanding his life underscores just how remarkable the American Constitution is. So we'll look tonight at Madison's life and how his presidency impacted on American Jews, but something else as well, the Constitution and its biblical roots. To what extent did the framers draw on their knowledge of the Bible? How similar or dissimilar was the Constitution in key respects to the Torah? And what were the major issues that Madison confronted as president? And what involvement did he have with the Jewish people, large or small? Of course, Madison presided over the first war on American soil since the Revolution, the War of 1812, and he successfully led the U.S. to one last victory, so to speak, over the British. And this happened despite the initial capture of Washington, D.C., and the burning of the White House. But we'll get back to that. So Madison was born in 1751 in Virginia. His father was a successful tobacco planter. And he was educated privately on the plantation until he went to college. And he went to Princeton. There he developed his aptitudes, and after graduation, Madison stayed on to study more, including a year of study in the Hebrew language with Princeton's president, John Witherspoon. And Madison was fluent in Hebrew his entire life, hard to imagine, but true. His parents were churchgoers, but like many of the founders, he tended towards deism, and he too was imbued with a sense of religious tolerance that colored his attitudes towards society. At Princeton, he was very studious, and even when he returned in his 20s to Montpelier, the estate, owing to his sickly nature, he remained a bookworm. Madison suffered from symptoms that are very similar to what today is called epilepsy. Then it was considered to be the work of Satan, something that might have turned him against traditional Christianity. So in fact, Madison was engaged to be married at age 30, but his fiancée broke off the engagement, and likely because of his malady. So in fact, Madison did not marry until he was 43, and like Washington and Jefferson, he too married a widow with a child, Dolly Todd, who was 26 years old, 17 years his junior. She brought one son into the marriage, whom Madison adopted. And like Washington, Madison had no natural children of his own. Dolly Madison became one of the most renowned first ladies. In essence, she created the position. And you won't be surprised to know that she introduced ice cream into the White House. Not easy, because they didn't have freezers. And the ice cream company was actually named for her, although they dropped the E. She spelled Dolly with an E before the Y, not before the D, if you're wondering. Now, Madison was drawn to the Revolution as well. A young Madison was greatly influenced by Patrick Henry's stirring speech in the wake of the Stamp Act. Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. That was Henry, and it stirred everyone in Virginia, including Madison. And Madison strengthened himself enough to train as a rifleman during the Revolution, but his real talents rested in politics, and he became a member of the Virginia legislature already in his 20s. Now there he amended Virginia's new law on religious freedom to remove the word toleration, which he felt was insufficient. So rather than the law read, and it's a critical difference, all men should enjoy the fullest toleration in the exercise of religion, his amendment was accepted. All men are equally entitled to the free exercise of religion. Toleration is almost a bidiavad. Enjoy equal rights? That's a bilchatchila. It's a different approach, a different emphasis altogether. So Madison was considered brilliant his entire life, and before long, he fell into Jefferson's orbit, and he remained close to Jefferson. It was Madison, for example, upon Jefferson's return from Paris in 1789, he was greeted with the news, Jefferson, that he was appointed Secretary of State. He knew nothing about it. It was Madison who told him the job had nothing to do with domestic affairs, which is really how it sounds, Secretary of State, but rather with foreign affairs as the President's top foreign policy advisor. So we discussed last week, Jefferson preferred to return to Paris, but he was persuaded to stay in the U.S. In 1789, Madison was elected to the House. He was bitterly opposed by Patrick Henry, who put up a young James Monroe as his preferred candidate. The two candidates, Madison and Monroe, took a liking to each other, and they began campaigning together, which is strange, for the same position, and they remained close for decades, except for falling out, which we'll discuss. Madison became Jefferson's Secretary of State, and Monroe, later, after they reconciled, became Madison's Secretary of State and his successor as president. But it was before all of this that Madison made his most important mark on American history and put himself in position to be president. And by that I'm talking about Madison's work on the Constitution at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. So how did Madison come to be called the father of the Constitution? Part of it was happenstance. Yep, in the right place at the right time. So he showed up early to the convention with most of the Virginia delegation. They were the first to come, and they're the ones then who set the rules. In the 1780s, as we know, the U.S. was governed under the Articles of Confederation that gave most power to the states and very little to the federal government. And that's how they wanted it, to prevent the rise of a despot. But the states themselves did not always get along, and there was no sense of commonality. Congress had no power to tax, and so the debts of the Revolution went unpaid. Remember, we discussed how this negatively affected Chaim Salomon. Wealthier states were more successful than smaller states. There was no army, there was no unity, there was no real nation. So what to do? Through the creation of a new constitution, the founders were trying to reverse the weakness of the Articles of Confederation. How weak were the Articles? Well, there were seven presidents of the United States before George Washington, all under the Articles of Confederation. Are any of them remembered? No. Even the first. Who was the first president of the U.S.? What's that? John Hanson was his name. Hanson. But in fact, Washington was the first president under the Constitution. But there were seven presidents before under the Articles. But Hancock was a good guess. You got a consolation prize. The job, though, had little meaning. It had little power. It's not to say it was ceremonial like you have ceremonial presidents across the world, but it really did not have the same influence and authority that it had from Washington on. The convention was called in Philadelphia, but not every state was in a rush to appear. Virginia came first. They just showed up. And therefore they played a disproportionate role in drafting the convention rules as well as the framework of a new government. And literally, I'm going to exaggerate, but by the time everyone else showed up, Virginia already had a plan that they submitted as a basic text over which they would negotiate. It was a long, brutal process, beginning in 1787, stretching through two steamy Philadelphia summers with much acrimony, many threats to walk out. Rhode Island didn't even show up, but they're such a small state, nobody noticed. Now, there were many open questions that they had to wrestle with. Should a new constitution be drafted, or should they just try to amend the Articles of Confederation? How should power be divided between the states and the federal government? How would the will of the people be heard? How would a balance be achieved between small states and large states? Will each state have one vote? Or will representation be based on population? Not to mention the big slavery question, which is a long discussion, and resulted in the Three-Fifths Compromise. Not to go too far afield, it should be understood, because people think today that the Three-Fifths Compromise was a racist sentiment that blacks are only worth three-fifths of a white. It was actually the opposite. The Three-Fifths Compromise was pushed by the North, not by the South. The South wanted the black slaves to be fully counted in their population, to bolster their numbers in the people's house and make them more powerful. But the North argued that if blacks cannot vote, so why should they be counted like everyone else? So in fact, the North suggested this to diminish the power of the South, holding open the possibility that down the road the government would legislate out of existence slavery. And so it was. If there's to be no freedom for blacks, then the North did not agree that each black slave should count as an equal of everyone else. So the compromise essentially benefited the North. Blacks would count in the population, but not fully. In any event, how does one go about creating a form of government completely unknown in the annals of history, really entering new and uncharted waters? And they did it. And for the most part, it worked. But based on what? Already in the 70s, when I was in law school, I became aware of a number of articles and monographs on this very topic, the biblical roots of the Constitution. I remember reading it in the 70s. And since then, there's been quite an extensive literature that's developed explicating that very point in a fascinating way. To quote from one, Professor Paul Eidelberg of Bar-Ilan, he said that the republic prescribed by the American Constitution is the longest lasting free government in history. I think Switzerland's longer, but right, let's not quibble. America saved Europe from tyranny three times in the 20th century, and today is the only solid bastion of freedom against totalitarian Islam. What is not generally known, however, is that the American Constitution was rooted in ethical and political principles whose source is none other than the Torah, the five books of Moses. And the question is how? Well, it was Madison who submitted what became known as the Virginia Plan that introduced the concept of a bicameral legislature, meaning two houses. The nature of that was hotly debated. Some wanted the Senate to be modeled on the House of Lords, where they serve for life. And so it was compromised. It wouldn't serve for life, but they serve a longer term. It wouldn't be a subject to recall like congressmen were. And it was Madison who did more than any other person, or as much as Jefferson, to ensure the drafting and ratification of the Constitution. It was Madison who addressed the convention hundreds of times, and together with Hamilton and John Jay, were the primary authors of the Federalist Papers, 85 essays published in newspapers in an attempt to win ratification of the Constitution, 1788-1789. But one factor that we should keep in mind ironic because it was intended as a purely secular construct, are the biblical roots of the Constitution, and of this we should be very proud. So we have to remember the founding fathers did not grow up in a vacuum. They did not know many Jews, but from Puritan times, as we discussed 2 weeks ago, they were steeped in knowledge of the Bible and ancient Israel. Remember the 15 capital laws of New England. Of the 15 capital laws, seven were the Shev Mitzvah Bnei Noach, listed in the original. In some respects, they romanticized Jews. In others, they no doubt looked to ancient Israel as the inspiration to resolve many of the conflicts that arose during the convention. In fact, there's something very natural about the descendants of people who saw their settlement here as the new Israel, looking to the old Israel for insight on how to form a government. Madison said it best, as he often did, when he remarked that every word in the U.S. Constitution decides the question between power and liberty. And those were the competing values. In a sense, we fight over them until today. You need power, a centralized government that can enforce the laws and protect the weak, create an entity that can unify so many disparate elements and defend itself against foreign invaders, but by the same token, not so powerful that it tramples on human dignity and freedom. Where there's too much power, dictatorship looms. Where there's too much liberty, anarchy is the frequent consequence. And this was the major issue debated at the convention for over 2 years. Madison, in Federalist 51, famously noted, it's a beautiful paragraph, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. So what is the appropriate balance? Madison had to convince Virginians first, because the Virginians, especially Patrick Henry, were the most stark in wanting a weak central government in order to bolster individual rights. So Henry especially was very leery about a federal government with too much power. And in fact, after it passed, that's why Henry turned on Madison and put up Monroe as his candidate for Congress. So what do the Torah and the history of Israel teach us? And isn't the question itself strange, considering that ancient Israel was a monarchy and the founders fled from any type of monarchy? So the answer is yes and no. What they saw and what the reality was that ancient Israel featured a balance of power among three sections of society. Really, three sections, three branches of government, in effect. The Melech, the king, was the most powerful, but so was the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was both a judicial and legislative body, in effect. The Sanhedrin not only adjudicated cases, but it passed laws. And the Navi was actually the third branch of government, of Jewish government. What we had in ancient Israel was what the framers came to call checks and balances. So the Melech was powerful, but the Melech had to be approved by the Sanhedrin. And the Melech, in theory, could be deposed by the Sanhedrin. The Melech could be, and often was, chastised by one of the Nevi'im, or more than one. The Nevi'im can serve on the Sanhedrin, but there was no role for the Navi in conveying to the Sanhedrin God's word, Lo Bashamayimi, the Torah is not in heaven. So Navi had no role in the Masorah as a Navi, although he could serve on the Sanhedrin if he was a Talmud Chacham. So too the Melech, if worthy, could serve on the Sanhedrin, but he had no role in Psak. The Melech couldn't even pass any laws. All laws, all regulations, all ordinances, Takanos, had to come from the Sanhedrin. If the king wanted to declare war, he needed permission from the Sanhedrin. What we had, it was classic checks and balances. The Navi and the Sanhedrin against the king, and the king otherwise exercising absolute power, including use of the military eminent domain, taxation, etc. If this sounds familiar, it should. Look at how the U.S. government was formed, born of compromise, and of course there couldn't be a navi in the American system. Article 1 of the Constitution describes what was to be the center of power, Congress. And Congress was composed of two bodies, one that would directly reflect the will of the people in a proportionate sense, the House of Representatives, based on each state's population, and the Senate was to be more elitist, and originally, and until 1913, elected by each state legislature, not by popular vote. That was a much more recent innovation. It was a constitutional amendment, actually. It was Congress that was authorized, just like the Sanhedrin was, to raise revenue, declare war, and make laws. Power in theory was thereby vested in the people, but not completely. The founders were also afraid of the tyranny of the majority. That's why the U.S. was never, is not a pure democracy. In a pure democracy, the majority always wins. The majority cannot always dictate, or we wind up with a majority tyrannizing the minority. What if the majority votes to stifle the free speech of one particular group? Well, hence the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights limits majority rule. Or in Jefferson's formulation that we're really living through today, Jefferson said, democracy ends the moment the majority realizes it can vote itself money out of the treasury. Boy, don't we know that? That was Romney's 47% crack. And why one political party today promotes income redistribution, the dispensation of free stuff to its voters, etc. When those voters are majority, then the treasury is just drained because they can vote themselves money or vote for people who give them the money. The framers therefore created not a democracy, but a republic in which there are guarantees of liberty that can never, in theory, be taken away, basic civil rights, and limitations on what even a majority of voters can do to the minority. That's Article 1. That's the center of power. That it hasn't worked out like that is a different issue. But then again, we'll see the monarchy of Israel didn't always work out that well. It's Article 2 that describes the president whose role as chief executive was to execute the will of Congress, ensure that the laws are enforced, and is commander-chief of the army. But the president is also bound by the law, like the Melech was. How do we know the king of Israel was bound by the law? Well, that's in the Torah. V'hayachis shifta kisei mamlachto, when the king sat on his throne, v'chasav los mishnatar azos al seif miftah konim aliviyim, he had to write a copy of the Torah, the Melech had to write for himself a Sefer Torah, and literally, Gemara says, he hung it from his chest. Like we have a mezuzah on the door, the Melech had to carry around a Sefer Torah with him. Leman yilmad liras Hashem elokav, he learned to fear God. Lishmoras kol divrei haTorah zos achukim ha'ela la'asosam, and observe what the Torah says, the laws and statutes. Levilti rum levavo, alech me'achav, he shouldn't become haughty. Levilti sur menem etzvayim en usval, he shouldn't deviate from God's command, right or left. Leman ya'arich yamim al mamlachto, hu vanav bekerv Yisrael, so his kingdom should endure. The king had to carry a Sefer Torah with him to realize that he too is bound to observe the Torah and to prevent the haughtiness that leads to sins and errors or the commission of crimes and misdemeanors. So the president can be impeached by the House and tried by the Senate for crimes and misdemeanors. That it doesn't work anymore doesn't mean that it can't work. Only the system's been corrupted by an imperial presidency that's now about a century old. The Melech was all-powerful, but he too was subject to the decisions of the Sanhedrin. Indeed, the king had no right, no authority to dictate to the Sanhedrin except one limited area. He couldn't demand the psak. He couldn't even demand the Sanhedrin, meaning the Beis Din HaGadol, meet when he wanted them to meet. So consider this as well. And you'll see the echoes of the American system. Gemara says in Brachos, Daf Nun Hamed Aleph, Ein Ma'amid in Parnasa LaTzibur, Ela Im Kein Nimlocha Mitzibur. You can't appoint a leader over the community unless you consult the Tzibur first. You can't impose a leadership. later in Jewish history, there become elections for leaders, but in biblical times, it went through the Sanhedrin. Ein Rambam in Hilchos Melachim Paragraph Halacha Gimel. Ein Ma'amid Melach Tchila El Al Pi Beis and Shalshivim Zkeinim El Pi Navi. You did not appoint a king at first, except through a Sanhedrin of 70, the Beis on Agadol, and a Navi as well. Ki Yoshua Sheminei Moshe Rabbeinu Veistino. Like Yoshua is appointed by Moshe and his Beis Din. That's how the king is appointed. Can a king be removed? All right, Abravanel says no. I trust he was being objective and not fearful in his milieu, you know, the Inquisition, to write yes. But he held the thought itself as tantamount to rebellion. But others disagreed. A melech could be deposed if he kills Beshogeg, sent to the Ermiklot. Certainly if he kills Bemezid. The Meiri says at the end of Horios, when the king deserves to be punished, ein melech vein sar. There's no king, there's no officers, like any other Jew. And for crimes and misdemeanors, so Radak says in Malachim about Achav, Avalim Hargim, the Gozlin, Shaloba Mishpat, Ho Yisra Mordimbo. If a king killed or robbed unlawfully, Jews would rebel. Kilo Hoyim Menichin Melech Alehem im Loyamid Eretz Bimishpat. They didn't appoint a king to act unjustly. A king exists to promote justice. And certainly if he endangered the nation, a king was liable to be killed, like David was justified in killing Shaul. Now, in practice, it was difficult. It didn't always work out well. And the Sanhedrin decided, in fact, not to judge Malchai Yisrael, who generally were a bunch of ruffians anyway. But Malchai Yehuda, they did judge. The Gemara Sanhedrin, if you test Aman Aleph. Or their Chaf Amid Beis. The king could declare war, he could conscript armies, raise taxes, but he needed the permission of the Sanhedrin in order to go to war. So the king had to be powerful, but also limited, answerable to some other body. As Madison wrote in Federalist 10, something we're living through today, enlightened statesmen will not always be at the helm. And he realized that. It's wonderful when you have a philosopher king. But when you don't, whether it's an American president or a Melech Yisrael, we also had bad kings, horrible kings, evil kings. But the system has to be resilient enough to survive bad kings and lahavdil bad presidents as well. The Tanakh unfailingly lists the sins of every king of Israel, except for one, Yotam ben Uzziah, apparently was a tzaddik, of whom nothing bad is said. So it didn't work perfectly. It didn't work perfectly because man is imperfect. But the system did endure. I'm talking about Malchus Yisrael, and we await its reestablishment. To look at it from a different perspective, the Articles of Confederation-type government should ring a bell because it bore a great similarity to the era of the Shoftim. Ish kalayosha be'enov yase. Each person did whatever he wanted to do. There were 12 tribes, not one nation. And often the tribes refused to go to war under the Shoftim if they weren't attacked. Dvar and Barak were able to muster 2.5 tribes to fight against Canaan. The others were not interested. A melech was needed to unite the 12 tribes into a nation. So alhamdulillah, a similar process unfolded here as well, to unite the 13 colonies into one nation, but at the same time allow each to preserve an independent identity. And it did exist, you know, the forgotten 10th Amendment to the Constitution, that anything, any power not otherwise delegated to the federal government explicitly is reserved for the states. That's how they saw it. The state should retain any other power that's not specified. Unfortunately, it hasn't worked out like that. And really, in the Obamacare decisions, John Roberts, the Chief Justice, put a stake through the heart of the 10th Amendment. Nonetheless, not to take the analogy too far, but the founders wrestled with the fact that there was great diversity among the colonies. Think about it, Maine and Georgia. Everything is different. The industry, the commerce, the way of life, even the way they pronounce English is different. So they had different economies, different cultures, and even different ways of looking at the world. The 12 tribes were similarly dispersed, and even the Mishkan Shiloh could not serve as a national center. That would have to wait for Yerushalayim. So what was the primary role of the king? The Rambam says is the Mora. The primary role of the king was unity, achdus, keep the nation together. Even the notion of local rule should sound familiar to us. Here Eidelberg quotes the pasuk at the beginning of Parashat Shoftim. Shoftim v'shotrim titein lecha b'chol she'arecha. You have judges and officers in all your gates. All your gates mean you're not going to be ruled by a central government. You'll be ruled, you'll be controlled, you'll be prosecuted if necessary by local officials. Local rule by the elect. Elect really means the carefully chosen, the select, like an elite. The beginning of Parshas Dvarim, Ve'kachas Rashei Shiftechem Anashim Chachamim Viduim, they're known. They can't be strangers. The leaders of each tribe were people selected by the tribe, or the tribal leaders. V'teinu Sam Rashim Aleichem, Sere Alafim, Sere Mios, Sere Chamishim, Sere Esaros, V'shotrim L'shivtechem, according to the tribes. Again, authority was localized. So the House of Representatives is a very representative, very localized body. In Tip O'Neill's famous phrase, all politics is local. At the end of the day, we care more about what happens in Teaneck than what happens in the Chicago or Patterson, for that matter, because our lives are affected most, or at least first and foremost, locally. And each tribe selected the best people to represent them. In a nation of laws, not men, the people have the ultimate say through their representatives. And this Chazal recognized as well. Ein gozrin gzera l'tzibur, elam kein rov tzibur yicholim lamod ba. You can't decree anything on the public unless the public is willing to accept it. So the House represents the people, whereas the Senate really represents the individual states. And there's one president, not a team, not a presidium. And there's also based in the Gemara, in Sanhedrin Daf Ches Amud Aleph, the two psukim that speak about Moshe's mandate to Yeshua. Ki atah ksiv, ki atah tavo es ha'om, ksiv atah tavi, you'll come with or you'll bring. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Moshe said to Yeshua, atov azkenim shebadori mahem, you and the elders will rule together. Amar lakadosh baruch hu, tul makel v'hachal kod kadom. God said to Yeshua, take a stick and whack them in the head. Dabar echad lador, vein shnei dabarim lador. A generation has one leader, not two leaders. You need one. You need that authority. You need that unifying figure. And finally, the Sanhedrin. Who's the arbiter of halacha? It's not the melech. It's the Sanhedrin. It's a more representative body, really based on merit. You go to the Kohen or the Shofet Hashem v'yom ha'im, you follow exactly what the Sanhedrin says. Just like the Sanhedrin interprets the Torah, so too the U.S. Supreme Court interprets the Constitution and even can sit in judgment of the constitutionality of laws passed by Congress, a right upheld in the American legal system by the ruling in Marbury versus Madison, 1803, so Madison was the new Secretary of State. Marbury was appointed a Justice of the Peace by Adams as he was leaving office, but his commission was not delivered in a timely fashion. Madison refused to recognize it, to honor it. The court ruled that he did not have to, they could not force Madison to accept Marbury, but nonetheless the statute under which he was to be appointed was unconstitutional, what is known as judicial review. Now most of the drafters of the Constitution supported judicial review in any case, but this was the first time the court exercised that right. Again, checks and balances. The court can't overturn an amendment to the Constitution, but they can overturn any law of the Constitution. What's interesting, I digress for 30 seconds, Israel tries to have it both ways. Israel has no constitution, but it does have a series of basic laws. The basic laws are passed by a simple majority, but nonetheless, because they're called basic laws, chukei yesodim, the high court, the Bagatz, has ruled that they can interpret laws of the Knesset based on their understanding of the basic laws, and even invoking Marbury versus Madison, that gives them the right to overturn the laws of the Knesset. Of course, the High Court, and this is taking it much further, directing the military what they can do, how they can treat terrorists, etc., things that in America would be considered non-justiciable. It's not an incorrect analogy to suggest that the relationship of the Torah Shebichtav, the written law, to the Talmud is like that of the Constitution and the decisions of the Supreme Court. The former are relatively terse texts. The latter are much more expansive and elaborate on what is in writing. The U.S. Supreme Court alone has published 600 thick volumes of its cases on constitutional law. The great legal scholar, Dean of Harvard Law, Roscoe Pound, said that the Constitution is stable, but that does not mean it stands still. All right? What's the balance between that? So, Lahavdil, we have similar debates in our world along those lines about the Torah. How can the Torah adapt to new situations, but at the same time remain stable? All right? You've taken everything from the way halacha is applied in a modern state to the area of women rabbis, which is another parsha again this week. It's that dichotomy between something which is stable but yet does not stand still. That tension exists in both worlds. To take it even further, the analogy, there are two schools of thought as to how the Constitution should be interpreted today. You have the originalists, the strict constructionists, meaning the role of the court, think Nino Scalia or Clarence Thomas, the role of the court should be to ascertain what the founders had in mind when they wrote this or that, versus those who see the Constitution as a living, evolving document that changes with the times. Well, that, in essence, is how the Orthodox versus the non-Orthodox view the Torah. The irony is that, of course, the Torah is divine, so there'd be more grounds to argue that the Constitution should change with the times, but the non-Orthodox apply the same formula to both. The Torah can change, and the Constitution can change as well. And, of course, the modern idea that a layman can just read the Torah or even the Talmud, and that qualifies them to paskin, is as ludicrous as the idea that a layman can look into the Constitution and decide what is legal or illegal, what is lawful or unlawful governmental conduct. These are sciences, specialized areas. You have to study it to understand it. But it should be no surprise that when the time would come and Jews coming into our own in America, we'd become leading constitutional scholars. Men like Brandeis and Frankfurter, because in fact, this type of analysis of texts and application of, say, again, Lahavdil, an ancient text to modern times, that's in our wheelhouse. That's an 85-mile-an-hour fastball down the middle. I'm not suggesting that Madison, you know, istakel ba'oraisa uvara alma, that Madison looked into the Torah and created a new form of government. What I am suggesting is that the knowledge was there, at least in part, and certainly the values were known to many of the framers, and they sought to avoid some of the pitfalls that we experienced, especially the hereditary aspects of monarchy that resulted in generations of evil kings. And you'll notice, even today, how wary Americans are of the hereditary presidency. There's a certain fatigue that's applied to a Bush or a Clinton, because been there, done that, let's get a new name out there. But the founders want to avoid that. There's nothing hereditary in American life. What neither system can really avoid are bad leaders. In our case, Rishoim, who became too powerful for the Sanhedrin to deal with. He had kings that killed off or attempted to kill off the Sanhedrin, like Yanai. And in America, lawless presidents who do what they want, flout the law and dare the courts to stop them or Congress to impeach them. The saving grace is that their term limited. One writer in this genre, Milton Konvitz, who was born in Tzfat in 1908, became a professor at Cornell, expressed a very beautiful thought. He subscribes to this theory also. And he said that the framers never proposed that God be mentioned in the Constitution. I quote, "The greatest tribute to religion is the translation of religion into morality." And that's how he saw the ideals of the Torah taken and manifesting in much of what became the American Constitution, and that's what had happened. What's the role of an ideal government? Well, that's how the Constitution starts. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Indeed, there was another powerful intellectual current in the 1780s that might have also had an influence on the framers. So the Jewish philosopher wrote in 1783 that man does not forfeit his natural rights when living in civil society. I quote, "Neither church nor state has the right to subject men's principles or convictions to any coercion whatsoever." He wrote, it's tyranny to deprive man of his right to determine his own thoughts and his own beliefs. So granted, the framers were most familiar with the writings of John Locke a century earlier, but it's 1783 when Moses Mendelssohn wrote this in his book, Jerusalem. Is it far-fetched to think that they were unaware of what Mendelssohn had written? I don't think so. Madison himself wrote years later to a Jewish correspondent and noted that, I quote, "The history of the Jews must forever be interesting." Well, that's true even today. And he added as well, in recognition of the American experiment, "The perfect equality of right which the American political system secures to every religious sect." Now, Madison's desire for a strong federal government was misconstrued by Henry, among others, as support for a monarchy. Not at all. Madison wrote, "The more simple, the more republican we are in our manners, the more national dignity we shall acquire." Republican here meant in the political, not the partisan sense, a state where power is vested in the citizens above all. And so it was in the debate over whether the U.S. should have a standing army or navy. And again, that was all discussed because a strong military could lead the leader into unwelcome domestic and foreign adventures. Madison was concerned, but he said at the convention, "Weakness, I guess we should take it to heart today as well, weakness will invite insults. The best way to avoid danger is to be in a capacity to withstand it." Or as the Romans said, "Si vis pacem, para bellum," take it to heart. If you want peace, prepare for war. All right, so let's look. Madison was elected president in 1808. He was the overwhelming party choice, although rift in the Democratic-Republican Party. Well, Jews had a hard time. A party called the Democratic-Republican Party. See, if you vote for the Democrats, you're voting for Republicans too. So what do? In any event, it led James Monroe, his friend, running against him on the same party line. So Monroe just got 3 electoral votes. The friendship ended for 2 years. Who was the instigator? Who do you think? Dolly Madison considered him a traitor and a rat. So he was banned. But they reconciled 2 years later. And then Madison appointed Monroe his Secretary of State, in which he served until he became president. Monroe also served the same time, later in the War of 1812, as the Secretary of War as well. Madison's main opponent was a John Randolph, and Madison won in a landslide. His vice president was George Clinton, former New York governor, who has the distinction of being only one of 2 men to serve as vice president under 2 different presidents. He served under Jefferson as well. John Calhoun was the other. Clinton had replaced Burr as Jefferson's vice president, and then he got the second highest vote total in Madison's election, and he served as vice president until he died in 1812. He's the first vice president to die in office. No one replaced him. In the election of 1812, there was another vice president elected under Madison, and he also died. So Madison became the only president whose 2 vice presidents died in office. No other person wanted the job after that. But you know, the town of Clinton, New York, is named after George Clinton. George had a nephew, DeWitt Clinton, who became New York governor and built the Erie Canal. Madison was a successful president. When he took office, the government had a surplus of $9.5 million. So he paid down the debt and he reduced taxes. And for the most part, he was very popular. But the major event in his term was the War of 1812. So just briefly, the war was a consequence of the Napoleonic Wars. The British began again intercepting American merchant ships that were bound for France. This is both economically harmful to the U.S. and a national insult, and the demand for war grew until Madison asked for a declaration of war from Congress. He got it, but along party lines. You shouldn't think that only recently do we fight over military adventures. Madison got about 60% of the vote in Congress. The Federalists were against the war. And in fact, they called it Mr. Madison's War, because as far as they're concerned, he was the one who brought it on the U.S., echoes of later chapters in American history. The war was underfunded, we're used to that as well. And the plan was that the U.S. would capture Canada, which was a British province at the time, and force negotiations. But it failed when New England, which was a Federalist stronghold, refused to form militias and fight. Battles were fought in Canada, on the Great Lakes, and in the U.S. itself. The Americans were defeated at the Battle of Bladensburg, Maryland, August 1814, right outside Washington. That led the British to capture Washington, including the White House. Madison and Cabinet fled to Virginia. After the British soldiers ate the dinner that had been prepared for Madison, they burned down the White House to the ground, along with other national buildings. Dolly Madison had the presence of mind, very famously, to rescue some precious artifacts from the White House, including Gilbert Stuart's famous portrait of George Washington. It was the first time in American history that the nation's capital would be attacked in wartime, and the only time, until Arab terrorists flew a passenger jet into the Pentagon on September 11th, 2001. The next month, September 1814, the U.S. successfully defended Fort McHenry, overlooking Chesapeake Bay, the battle that inspired Francis Scott Key to write the Star-Spangled Banner. The flag to which he referred is still on display in the Smithsonian, and then the tide of the war changed. The war had an equivocal ending. I was talking to someone here before, British origin, went back to Israel tonight. He was here the first 2 weeks, and he said that growing up in Britain, they never thought about the War of 1812. It just didn't mean that much to the British. American casualties far exceeded those of the British casualties, and they just, both sides got tired of the war, and the Brits were involved in European wars in any event. The Treaty of Ghent, negotiated between both sides, basically, it went back to square one. All occupied lands, U.S. and Canada, returned. Both the U.S. and Canada claimed victory, and the British still did not concede American shipping rights in the Atlantic. The real losers were the Indians, who went to war on the side of the British and lost big time, as American forces, under the command of, among others, General Andrew Jackson, we'll hear from as well in a few weeks, opened up the Deep South, Alabama, Louisiana, Florida, to American conquest. Indeed, the Battle of New Orleans took place after the treaty was signed, but before word could reach the U.S. that the war was over. Two Jews became well known for their part in the war. Well, only one. Charles Harvey became the first Jewish naval officer, but it was Uriah Phillips Levy, I mentioned a few weeks ago, as the grandson of Jonas Phillips, who had fought in the Revolution. Uriah Phillips Levy was from a family on both sides, very active in Mikveh Israel in Philadelphia. Interesting chap. He became a seaman at a very young age. I mean a very young age. He left home at 11 to his parents' horror. They were not happy, they didn't talk to him, and they only reconciled when he returned home at 13 for his bar mitzvah. And then he went back out to sea. When the war started, he was given command at age 21 of the brig Argus. It was transport ship, basically. He was later captured by the British, held as a POW until war's end. So Levy was appointed later the first Jewish commodore of the Navy. He had a distinguished but very challenging career in the U.S. Navy. endured consistent Jew hatred from his fellow Navy men. He did not take any guff. He always fought back. And so he was court-martialed 6 times. And nonetheless, he was promoted. In one memorable incident, a drunken officer kept bumping into Levy and his date at a dance. Levy finally slapped him, was challenged to a duel. In the duel, Levy killed him, and then he was tried twice for murder, once by the Navy and once by the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Both times he was acquitted. But get out when the getting's good. He became successful in New York real estate, became very wealthy, became a philanthropist, and among his holdings, Uriah Phillips Levy in 1834 bought Thomas Jefferson's Monticello estate. He loved Jefferson. He used Monticello as his vacation home. His mother was even buried there, still there, after she died. And many, many years after his death, the Levy family donated Monticello to the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, which administers it until today. There was one other famous individual that we discussed briefly last week and even more next week. In 1813, Madison appointed the first Jew, the first Jewish diplomat. I'm sorry, it was 1811, he appointed Mordechai Manuel Noah as the U.S. consul in Riga, in Latvia. In 1813, he was transferred to Tunis, the Barbary States. Noah was also from Philadelphia, and he negotiated the release of American hostages, which again had picked up, notwithstanding the first Barbary Pirates War. In a very controversial move, Noah was recalled from Tunis in 1815, before the last Barbary War, by the Secretary of State James Monroe, who wrote to him that when he was appointed, they were unaware that Noah was a Jew. And that fact disturbed the Arabs, talking about Tunisia, Libya, Algeria, the North African coast. In diplomatic parlance, they wrote to him, I quote, "It was not known that the religion you profess would form an obstacle to the exercise of your consular functions, in consequence of which the president, Madison, has deemed it expedient to revoke your commission." Now, it turned out the Arabs had said nothing. Noah was incensed, and other prominent Jews leaped his defense, sending letters to the government. Now, some argued that the religion aspect was a pretext, that, in fact, Noah, on authority of the State Department, had paid ransom for the release of the American hostages, and Madison or Monroe did not want to publicize that they paid ransom, but the damage was done. Monroe had to do damage control with the Jews before the election of 1816, which he won, and the State Department admitted its mistake in 1817, although Noah was not restored to the diplomatic service. We'll yet hear from him again next week, one of the most remarkable and not well-known incidents in Jewish history, Noah's attempt to establish a Jewish homeland in upstate New York in consequence of the way he was treated here. What's that?
I thought it was
it. No. I actually passed through there last summer. Not a Jew in sight, if you want to know. In any event, we'll close with this. In 1815, the Barbary Pirates were acting up again for years. And when the War of 1812 ended, Madison sent American naval forces to the North African coast once again. And this time they didn't pussyfoot around. The Arab pirates were routed. All the hostages were freed. And the U.S. even took back, get this, they took back to the States 7 Arabs who put on display in New York theaters as, I quote, "real bona fide imported Turks." They generally called Muslims Turks then. They put them on display as trophies of war. This ended Muslim hostilities against the United States until the Carter administration with Iran, and then, of course, the constant wars of the last 30 years. Madison lived almost 20 years after he left office. He struggled financially. His plantation almost collapsed while he was in office. And he had very little money, never got back on his feet. but he remains enshrined in American history as the father of our Constitution, and in our history as yet another president whose religious tolerance made Jews feel welcome and safe in the American Republic. Next week, we'll look at the presidencies of James Monroe and John Quincy Adams. I thank you all very much. Erev Tov.